So I'm in the Belgium Pavilion with Luke Tromans, who has made an absolutely beautiful show here. And we're going to walk around the space and talk a little bit about the work.
Yes, I think it's important to start with the first painting of the show, which is also a little bit the title of the show, which is called Monarchy Toko. It's a painting of the king of the Belgians, the former king, actually. And it's a painting where he actually gets out of a plane on the tarmac in Leopoldville in 1955. It was his first visit to his former colony, to his colony at that time. And actually it was a very important one because the Congolese population expected a lot of it. So they gave him a nickname, Monarchy Toko, which means beautiful white boy. And the government actually changed it immediately to Monarchy Toko, which means beautiful white ruler. And of course, for African people, by no means a person who is unmarried and has no kids could be seen as a chief. But nevertheless, the government imposed, of course, because they had the colony still, that upon all the other people. One sees a person coming out of an airplane in a white uniform, which is a sort of amplifies the strangeness of the surroundings he's in. His face is masked by sunglasses and painted in a sort of washed-out way, like a Walter Sickert painting. And in a sense, it's this idea of, for the Belgians, this posture of the king will remain. They will know him. He was the last autocratic, aristocratic king that we had. The one we have now is like a bartender. So in a sense, this is like the remainders of a history we are looking about. He was also the last unionist, in the sense that he wanted to keep the country together because we have a divided country with two languages. And then there, of course, is the fact that it's a hot team, because the protagonist and the antagonist are in this show. There's also a portrait of Lumumba in this show, which is like nearly opposite to the king. And there's a commission running now as we speak that is actually investigating in how far actually the king himself, the former king, was involved in the murder of Lumumba. And so yesterday, in all the newspapers in Belgium, on the front page, there was either the king or Lumumba. So you can imagine what kind of commotion is stirred up. The idea is actually to, and that's the beautiful thing with the whole idea of the pavilion here, is that although all these paintings were already sort of finished, and I was contacted in a very late stage to do this biennial, and first of all, maybe didn't want to do it because career-wise it's not really necessary. But since the theme of the work is so burning, and this pavilion is a Belgian pavilion, and also the Venice Biennale has been politicized from the start because it's like a graveyard for the arts, in the sense that everybody has his own pavilion, and that already is a sort of political statement. It was a chance I could not delude. I mean, I could not let that one pass. So in that sense, it's not so much what the world thinks about this pavilion, but what the Belgians think about their own pavilion. And alongside the painting of Lumumba, and Lumumba is painted here as a sort, not as a hero, but actually as a black intellectual. Actually, the suit is painted in a way that is not really worked out. And that's in order to emphasize upon the point that at that point in history, black intellectuals were seen as some sort of walking categorical mistake. He was also the president of the Evolués, which was a system the Belgians installed in the colony, and that literally meant that you could become evolved, because in a sense that the old colonizers would check up on you, how you would live and everything, and then you get a sort of diploma. And he was the president. And he once said to one Belgian colonizer, he said, if we want to do this system, then it will take about 100,000 years before everybody is evolved. On the other hand, the more grimmer theme behind the whole work and the whole idea of the colony is that it, since its existence, under the cloak of dissolving slavery, which Leopold II started, it installed a very fearful and crude system of forced labor. That finally, if you like coop up the whole duration they had it, has killed 9 million people. That's kind of an important statement. The other images in the show is also an image of a reconstruction image. It goes back on a documentary where they reconstructed or reenacted actually the place where Lumumba and his full cabinet was murdered in Katanga at a certain night, a certain given night in June. What you see is actually the American cars that pollute the jungle at the verge of, it's like an afterimage of driving back or driving away. And one of the cars' lights are pointed at a tree, which gives the element of a body, which gives the element of a sacrifice, and also gives you the element of voyeuristic imagery.
Very filmic as well.
That is actually derived directly from a documentary. Therefore, also the blue colors on top of the surface, which make an indication to the digitalized imagery. And then there's more intrinsic imagery. There's also more iconic, like in the see-through, the first image you see when you come to the pavilion is actually going back to child's memory.
What is this piece again?
This is a piece that's called Diorama, and it's like you have dioramas in colonial museums. And so we have a very important colonial museum, which is called the African Museum in Brussels. And the first touchdown with exoticism as a kid is like a school trip to this museum. It's the most racist museum you can imagine, and it's a very particular one. And so you have all these vitrines with these stuffed animals. Now, what I did is not used, I used that as an idea, but I actually used a toy, which is very small, of a rhinoceros, and put it in my own setting of a diorama, in order to make it possible that you could look upon it instead of that you're in front of it, and therefore also to dwarf the monumentality of the image and to show that you have to make a very, very, very big painting in order to make a small thing. And in that sense, it's also taking away the monumentality and also the pseudo-scientific approach these things have.
It also fades it out. I mean, it keeps the foreground and the background very close together,
yeah,
which is obviously significant.
Yeah, and it's also meant to be looked upon from very far away. And so the idea is also to bring the museum into the pavilion. That's kind of important. And next to that, there are other images. There's the image which is like another iconic image is the leopard skin. The leopard skin was by no means a universal symbol of power. And actually, this is an interesting story to amplify the idea how actually ideas and meanings can shift. So this especially iconic image of the leopard skin was taken out of the colonies by the Belgian people because only in a couple of villages it was the symbol of the chief. So they took it out of the country, re-imported it, and at the time Baudouin went to the Congo, it was the universal symbol of power.
How did that happen?
They made their own power, even if it's a concoction, and they threw it back at their colony. So when he came back to the country, and that's what the image is about, you see two black hands holding the leopard skin on the floor, and you see the feet of the king, who was the only person who could possibly cross over the leopard skin. And therefore also Mobutu with the leopard cap, or even Gaddafi. So the leopard skin as a powerful or royal symbol is actually a Belgian concoction. And then there's an image of a black man, of a pygmy, which is not really a real person. It's a sculpture in an Antwerp bar near the Diamond District and the railway station where you have a lot of people from the Russian mob. And I was sitting there with my wife and having gone to the film and felt a piercing gaze in my neck, turned around and saw a polychrome image of a pygmy, like nearly real. And here you can see all the elements of fascination white people could have for black people through the muscles, and the muscles are rendered within the paint, and also the idea with the whole sexual connotations. And this is then thrown back at you through the gaze. This exoticism is thrown back at you through the gaze of the sculpture in a very aggressive way.
Totally, yeah. Yeah.
And then there is an image of the plotters, because there is an image of Mobutu and is the people that actually, and its advisors, somewhere in Katanga, the place where eventually the cabinet as well as Lumumba was murdered. Now, one sees that this painting, Tshombe in the middle with one of his, as I said, advisors, also a military advisor, was already an indication to Mobutu. And Mobutu was the person that Lumumba trusted, and that was his biggest mistake. He put him at the head of the Congolese army. He created massacre on massacre deliberately in every province. So the situation became extremely unstable. The Belgians came back in with their army, so-called, to save their own people. But Lumumba and Kasavubu, that was the president of the former Congo, actually saw that as an invasion. So Lumumba rendered himself to New York to talk to the United Nations. They didn't want to help. The CIA wanted to get into the country because of the huge amounts of uranium. It was the Cold War period. The Belgians were thinking of, that was also an hypothetical statement, that the Belgians maybe made this independence very quick in order to actually sort of loosen the influence and the American push, but to keep their own influence. So here you see Chombit, who was a sort of puppet leader from the Belgians, surrounded in a conversation as a rumor. And then there are other images. There is the image of the mission, which I photographed myself in the outskirts of Lumumbashi, which is still operational, as the stronghold of education and civilization, looking like a fortress at the verge of dissolving itself.
With a storm, almost.
And then next to it, you have actually a very emblematic, more cryptic image, which is built together myself. These are the gloved arms and hands of my wife holding two pieces of chalk. And this goes back to an anecdotal history, which is actually very recent. When, after the execution of Lumumba and his cabinet, the Belgian government appointed two colonial policemen to dispose of the bodies. They were there to dissolve the bodies in an acid bath, so everything would disappear. Now, before doing that, one of the policemen had a hunch that Lumumba could and maybe would become, in mythological, a very important person. So he tore two teeth out of his mouth. And he kept them till last year, because that's when they started up the Lumumba Commission and then threw them in the North Sea. And he died just a couple of months ago. What I actually did, to emphasize on that, the idea of mutilation is the two black hands, actually, which are gloved hands, and chalk, as I know it from my children's, as a kid in school, which means yellow on the outside, white on the inside, to emphasize upon two things, the teeth, but also the failure of the educational and the missionary mission of civilization as a whole.
When I came in, I had no idea, and I haven't read anything. It's incredibly political. Is your work always this political?
The work is not always this political, but it has a tendency to be that. And I mean, it's also necessary, I think.
Mm.
So in a way, it's important to me that I know what I'm painting.
So you feel that politics is a very important thing to do, not just because of this platform of the Biennale, within your work in general?
Yes, I think it's interesting for an artist to at least open a discourse and take in a position. I mean, you cannot be utterly stupid when you make a painting.
No. And how do you feel about Documenta in its evolution of creating talks and criticism and very, very politicized?
I think that's a very good way of doing things and breaking it open. And I already had a couple of talks with Ocarina Razor about that. And so I'm very confident that something interesting will come out of it. And also, I mean, it's a very difficult position, because here you have a person who is part of the diaspora and who is right in the middle of those things. And the expectations on the two sides are different. The West wants an exhibition about globalization, which maybe not always be the most accurate way of rendering things. And I think the other side wants to be, it's a question of self-esteem, wants to be portrayed on an equal level. So it's always the same game. But of course the candy is still handed out from the West.
And back to the Biennale, you said that this was an exhibition that you made kind of primarily for the Belgian people themselves.
Not completely, of course. I never make a painting specially for somebody or whatever. That's not true. But I mean, of course, as it is now, as it stands now, it becomes extremely important for them.
Sure. So it's some kind of coming to terms with.
So it's firing back, actually. It's like an implosion.
Sections of the Magic Flute recorded in the Church of San Leo, the Latvian pavilion, which accompanied films by Leila Pekinina, Vistras Karis with Ilmars Bloombergs.
Okay, so I'm here in the Dutch pavilion with Lisa May Post. And we're just going to walk around the show a little bit.
Maybe we can begin with the new work.
Okay.
Yeah?
What's the title of this piece?
While.
While.
While, yeah.
And can you describe it?
There's four people sitting in kind of a hall. It's not very distinctive place. It could be a waiting room, or it could be a hospital, or I would say a place where you sort of encounter the effects that you have to wait in line to order, get something from the society, or to get a message, or
to leave.
To leave, yes. And it could be also a medical situation. There's three people you see from the front and one you see sitting from the back. And after a while, there's slowly black confetti falling from the sky on them and on the floor. And they do notice, but they're not really looking where it's coming from. But they do notice, and they're just sitting there. And at one point, One of them is taking a few of the bits of the black confetti off the shoulder of another person, and then the woman is looking to the men who are taking this from the shoulder. So there's a brief moment in which there's a connection.
In that moment, actually, when she looks, it's almost as if she looks before.
Yes.
Like, it's almost as if her look makes one man touch the other one.
It's one of those things you sometimes, when you feel when you're in the tram or in a bus, and in Holland you have trams, so you see someone with a hair or dandruff on his shoulder, and you feel like taking it off. At the same moment, when you're almost reaching out with your hand, you realize that it's actually, you know, something you don't do anymore. And I was thinking that probably in prehistoric times we used to do those kind of things with lots of more people, and I just wondered why those things have stopped.
So I guess that's why it's in this very neutral public space. It's obviously a public space, isn't it?
Yeah.
And so the immediate association is that these people don't know each other and are kind of forced to be in the same space.
Mm-hmm.
And it definitely is a forced community somehow.
Yes. Yes.
And that gaze really causes a puncture in
mm-hmm.
something.
Yes. I was reading a book, and they were talking about the link that separates. And the paradox was very much something I was thinking about, because it has to do with lots of things in my work, that you can have a link that separates you, or that you can have a separation. That's the only thing that links you, can be a separation. I really do think that in my former work, many of the people in it are very solitary, and I do feel that actually I've encountered something in my life that it's also not necessary anymore.
The confetti is very strange. It immediately transports this space into being something very dreamlike, doesn't it?
Yes.
And also peculiar, because you can't really tell it's confetti. It's black, which is very unusual.
Mm-hmm.
So it doesn't have this very jolly feeling, but it does transport it somewhere completely other into something dreamlike. What made you choose the black confetti? And why confetti at all?
Well, it was actually something that started out from a festive failure feeling. Well, one moment we were organizing a party, but it sort of failed, because we did many different kind of efforts through each other, and in the end there was this whole quite empty space filled with the confetti. And suddenly I think it would be really nice if they were all black, and it would be much closer to the truth of the situation.
It also, of course, is very autumnal. You know, as soon as this is falling, it's like a season passing. So the next piece is a photograph which is beautifully lit in this dark space, which I read it's called Nightlight.
We tried to, already a month ago, we went here to do a certain kind of foil on the windows, which lets through about one lux, and that's kind of measurement for light. And so you don't bump into each other. It's not a black box, and you can see the films. There's enough darkness that you can see the films very well. And I really also wanted to think of a space where photography next to film can have very equal ways of seeing. So this is a light on top of the photograph, which is a kind of theater light, which you can make completely into a square. It looks almost like a light box, but it isn't. So I didn't have the feeling I had to change the work into a light box, which would feel like a letdown to my photography, because I never used to make any light boxes.
Mm-hmm. Can you describe the actual image and the title of the work?
The title is Misprint. It's a hospital scene where two legs are sticking out behind a curtain next to a bed. The legs look like they're a doll, but they're not. They're real legs. But there's a kind of brownish makeup paint on the legs, and they're wearing white stockings. But the paint from the legs is painted over the white stockings. So it looks like a doll that's made in a wrong sense, because there's also this kind of plastic things on the sides of the legs.
It looks like either from a casting.
Yeah, a mold. It's like a mold. And the idea when I made this was that when you enter this world, you get a ticket, and sometimes you get the wrong ticket, and then your mold is a little bit dented, and you don't come out properly. And I think that has to do with that effect that cannot be changed. When you get born, there's a few effects that you just, you can't alter very much. Yeah.
Also, the legs are standing in front of a bed, and the curtain comes down and hangs almost like a skirt.
Yes, this is an older piece from 1993, and this is the one that's really close. Also, at that time, I was really working quite obviously, maybe from experiences in my youth. As a child, I've been sitting under a hospital bed, and I've heard, let's say, life-changing comments or things happen above me while I was sitting underneath the bed. I heard things that were going to have huge effects on my life. So I think that's kind of a moment that was imprinted in my memory very much. And I think that's why I have this image of these legs, sort of.
From definitely a ground perspective.
Yes, definitely, yeah. This one is called Under. You see a cellar with actually five people. Boy dressed in black on the side. There's another person
behind.
Sitting. But you hardly see her. And there's a yellow stretcher on the floor, and it's kind of sandy on the floor of the cellar. She's seen from the back. Then there's one guy who walks around in a kind of a bag.
It looks like a dress or a sarong or something, but it's actually a sack in which she... Yes, it's very beautiful textile.
Yes, it's actually just made from a sheet. I wanted him to be not very handy person, and he's quite long. This guy's 2 meters tall, and the space is too small for him, so he has to bend his head, and he's stumbling from one person to the other, trying to sort of make contact, but it doesn't really work out. And she's sitting with her back to us on the yellow stretcher. And in the end of the film, she gets up and looks back to where she just has been seated, and to the dent in the plastic of the stretcher. There's a small window in which you see people coming by. You see some bikes, people walking by.
The ankles.
Yes. And in the sound you hear, now it's difficult to hear because there's so many people in here, but you hear... people walking on top of this floor, and every now and then you hear somebody who steps onto the ledge.
I see. So it seems all of the works come out of dream-like things or memory.
I think many of things are a combination also of things that do come from there, but also things that you find yourself in that day. I see much broader perspective. Many people are so busy with doing and having that they forget that there's also just being, and I think that's a pity.
I'm here with Igal Samona outside the Israeli Pavilion. Igal, I'd like to just talk a little bit about your creation of this show and how it came about, the process between the choice of the artist and yourself. How did this happen, the collaboration?
The process was this time different than each year, because usually what is done in the Israeli pavilion, and also in most of the pavilions of the Biennale, is that there is a committee that chooses a curator, and the curator chooses the artist. This time Israel has decided to do it differently, and there was a committee of different professionals who has chosen the artist, and the artist has chosen me as his curator, which is a very interesting way to approach this kind of relation, curator and artist. I knew the artist since at least 20 years, because I'm now the chief curator of the Israel Museum. I started as curator of Israeli art at the Israel Museum in Jerusalem, and one of the exhibitions I did was a one-man show for Uri Katzenstein, so I know him since he was a very young artist and a beginner. And we collaborated in many, many ways during the years. And in a way it was, I think, I hope, obvious or normal choice from his side to choose me. And I feel very privileged in that sense. And the fact that the curator is chosen by the artist is, I think it may give a kind of, add a kind of coefficient of modesty and humbleness to the curators. And I have the feeling that the last year's curators became a little bit too much of stars. And this process is very interesting in that sense. I think the real center should be the artist, and that's really what happens in this kind of situation and cooperation. And the work has been going along very well. I mean, we met, Uri Katzenstein had this idea of a film since the beginning. He was chosen because of that. And then we discussed the film, and I hope that I helped to shape and to make the concept clearer during our conversations. I was, of course, the one who wrote the text for the catalogue, and the text is a kind of, I wouldn't say explanation, but it's a kind of an interpretation, personal one, but I hope it helps people to better see different angles of his work.
Also, you have, during the Biennale, you have performances as well by the artist.
Yes.
So, can we talk a little bit about that and how that dovetails into the whole concept of the work?
Yes, of course. I must say that the artist is, first of all, a performer. The artist has started performing about 30 years ago. He studied in the United States and began his first performances in the United States, in San Francisco, and later in New York, and then in Israel. He was one of the first professional performers, performance artists in Israel. And the performance here is done, of course, only for the three first days of the preview, not later on. And he's doing it in collaboration with two other artists, Ohad Fishoff, who is a dancer and, I would say, a movement artist. And Renan Arras, who is a dancer.
Who also appears in the film.
Appear in the film, but who appears only in the performance. And the performance is based, first of all, on a series of sequences of movements that really relate to the film, that relate to the different movements of the film, to the music of the film, to the main, if you want, subject matters the film deals with. And since the film really deals in essence with communication, science, with the tension between life and all the systems of communication and of signage, the performance does the same. And in a way, what we feel or should feel when we see the performance is as if we would be in front of a very weird and strange ritual of a culture we don't know, of a new culture. And in a way, it's also the essence of our sentimental approach to the film itself. And Katzenstein himself, who is not a dancer but just a performer, is participating in this performance. He has some blood extracted from his body and is put into a syringe, and he writes on the walls during the performance.
Oh, which is obviously, yes, in that space as you go in,
yes,
that's
exactly
where the writing,
exactly, the red writing, the writing
is actually from
his,
the blood,
his own blood, exactly.
Oh, so gradually there is more and more writing during,
exactly,
the 3 days,
exactly,
that's added to like a dialogue,
exactly,
with the work,
exactly. And then the walls after these 3 days looks a little bit like the walls in a cell of a crazy maniac who wrote with his own blood on the walls. It has this thrilling little bit, or a prisoner that before being sentenced writes his last messages on the wall. It has something almost hysteric, and at the same time these words are unknown to us. We don't understand the words, and it's a different language, a new language.
Oh, it's done in a new language, so that it's not meant to be,
exactly, it's
translated,
a kind of no
language,
non languages.
So also, when you go into the pavilion as well, you've got the different screens, and they're working in different ways from each other, you're getting slightly different view, and you can't see everything at once, but you're surrounded by these different perspectives of the performance. I mean, is that very much the tradition of his work, to work in that way with the different viewpoints?
No, that's absolutely...
It's done for this.
It's done for this. It's new, it's a new approach, and in a way it makes you feel as being in a kind of total environment. I mean, you are submerged, or you are enveloped with movie and film, with moving images. And the fact that there are many screens, and it is the same episode but shown in many screens, you feel that in a way you lose your own very clear and fixed identity, and you are splitted. And this feeling of being suddenly having a splitted identity makes you understand the world in a different way, physically, with your own body.
I'm here with Ohad Fischhoff, who is one of the performers in the Israeli... What would you call it? How would you call your performance part of the...
Part of the whole piece, which is called Home.
Yeah.
Part of the whole building. The building is kind of works as a unit, as a whole unit. At least that's what we try to do.
So can you talk a little bit about your performance and your relationship to the artist, how the artist chose you to be part of this performance? And
sure. I've been making work with Uri Katzenstein for 7 years now, I think. And we both like to do lots of different things in sound and performance work and sculpture and writing, and we've been kind of developing this sort of theatrical language of ours for a couple of years now, and he was the one to invite me to participate in the Biennale, being responsible for the performance element of the whole piece, which also consists of the video installation and the sculptures.
And during the performance, it's not you who draws your... Is it you who draws in the blood?
No, that's Uri.
Uri draws in the blood during the performance.
Yeah.
But you're going to perform at 6 o'clock, I think, aren't
you?
So we'll be able to see what what happens.
Yes.
And then after the first 3 days, the performance exists as a video?
We do 6 days of performances, and then we're going to video it, and then
it becomes a piece or not.
Yeah, we're going to leave a video next to the room in which we were performing.
I'm here with Uri Katzenstein at the Israeli Pavilion. Uri, you just finished a quite magnificent performance to coincide with your work. I'd like to talk about, first of all, the video installation and the ideas, the narratives, the language behind it, and then to move on and talk about the performance specifically.
Okay, the whole building was actually thought of as one package, or as one home, as one elaborate place. The work deals primarily with human situations that we have taken them to extremes, like the scene with the pet, for instance, right? Which is so common in large cities, where you see people walking around with dogs and they have this look in their eyes that kind of tells you that this is all they actually have, you know, things like that. It deals primarily with human conditions that are somehow not too elaborate and yet touching, I think. The world that I've presented is a sort of world that is parallel to ours, and one of the reasons that all of the figures in the movie look like myself is because there are several reasons, actually. One of the reasons is the fact that I deal with my body, and I've been dealing with my body for many years, and the body is sort of a hanger or a departure point for all my activities. And I feel like I have the right to only really deal with my own self when it comes to body. It deals also with the situation of multiple personalities. You're one thing in the morning when you get up at home. 1.5 hours later, you're doing something entirely different. 3 hours later, you go to the gym. 6 hours later, you see your lover. 10 hours later, you're mommy again or daddy again. And then you go out to some business meetings, etc., etc., etc. So it sort of portrays the various positions that one touches or encompasses on a daily basis. Human behavior is really one of my interests, and everything that has to deal with human behavior is human for me, even if it's foul behavior or obscene behavior or criminal behavior, etc. It's all human. There's, of course, the narcissistic point of view of Narcissus kissing himself and not really dying, not really being swallowed by the water, actually having like a different life after he kisses himself.
Also in your work, there is more, there's an unpeeling in the performance. You also deal with language, both the way you write in blood on the wall during the performance, which is your own encodation, your own language, as well as a kind of sign language, which is sometimes obvious but dense at the same time because it doesn't add up. There's a fracture in the work. Could we talk a little bit about that?
It's really important for me to say that I've been trying very hard to avoid language in my own way, but I've come to the conclusion that I can't really live without a language. So one of the ways for me to deal with this fantasy was to create a new language, or a kind of a new language, or a language that correlates to a whole world that deals with this language. The letters that you've seen in the performance and in the movie are actually invented letters. I'm going to link them to the ABC, and this is like one of my next projects where it's going to be linked to ABC, and I'll be actually writing real stuff with it, I mean real writing. The writing itself...
So it can be decoded?
Yes, exactly.
At the moment it can't be?
Yeah, at the moment...
You only have
this
the
work,
code.
Yes, with this work it can't be... you can't understand it. The blood writing is, again, another facet that deals with the body, my own fluids, ancient writing, detective material, detective writing... palimpsest, writing on writing on writing on writing, layers of writing, brotherhoods, blood brotherhoods, also the fact that it is red. I mean, blood is red, and red is a color that is totally coded. I mean, it ranges from ideas like heat, love, awareness, bewareness, etc., etc., etc. So, and it becomes like body ink. It becomes like a body ink.
Also, in your performance, you have yourself performing a dancer, a male and female dancer. Mm-hmm. And can we talk a little bit about the movements? They're, I mean, they're strange, they're magical, the costumes. It's very dramatic. You have this lightning effect at the beginning, electric noises, your voice as well. You've worked before in your work with voice. Mm-hmm. And you use...
Yeah, I'm manipulating
your voice,
my voice.
You're manipulating your voice. Can we talk a little bit about that as well?
Yeah.
The work, the world that I deal with, usually with electronic music, has to do a lot with sonifications and the kind of sonar information and audio information that usually surrounds music. In a way, this whole piece is a kind of a trying, or like a trial point, to try and create a new ritual. I'm talking about a new ritual which differs from our everyday rituals, because to brush your teeth in the morning is a ritual, and, you know, to wear your glasses and to smoke your cigarette, or, you know, to all these everyday life things have become like very obvious rituals, and this is kind of taking all of this and trying to put it in a different place where people can see it, imagine it, but it's secretive. The work does not give total answers. It doesn't give a total clue. It is secret. I mean, it kind of like encompasses a secret.
So now I'm in a Nordic pavilion, talking to Carl Michael von Hauswolf. Carl, this is, in a sense, a collaborative exhibit, isn't it? Because I think it involves five artists who've come together to make this work. Could you start by just describing the environment we're in? Because we can hear the sound clearly.
We're in this pavilion, who was like built in 1963, I think, by Norwegian Sverre Fein. And when we came here in January to scout out the location, we realized that architecture is in itself very beautiful, and we really don't need to do anything. We just like clean it up and you know, bring people here. Then, of course, we wanted to sort of work with the architecture and with the whole environment here. So that's why we have, for instance, set up like large curtains in front of the windows, just to seclude it a little bit more, to sort of close it up a little bit more, and clean it up, and then use the audio, the sonic qualities of this room.
On the left here, we see a structure with very fine wire, like piano wire, stretched along the whole side of the pavilion. Is it part of the acoustic element?
It's not, but it might be if one doesn't put that to question, but leave it open. It actually might sort of interfere with the acoustic, but it does not. It doesn't give sound at all. But the feeling that this wire construction is sort of connected to the sound is very sort of immediate, I think.
Because it would, in its own right, vibrate in relation to
yes,
the sound.
Yes, I mean, basically, it's an enormous harp, really.
Where the actual building is part of the sounding board,
yes,
as it were.
The sound we hear is maybe we can get over there. The sound that we hear now is a massive amount of radio receivers, Italian and international radio programs. We built a special radio receiver that receives a lot of stations, but also puts them out at the same time, right? So what you hear is a cluster of radio stations, and then run through a slight echo to give it a more, a little bit more of a contextual kind of a feeling in a way. I think it invites you to just feel it. I mean, for me, sometimes it sounds really, in a way, religious, which I was surprised to experience. I didn't really think it was going to. I was going to feel like that, but it has some kind of a mass feeling for it, some kind of a requiem kind of feel to it.
It has slightly the sense of going into a cathedral or a big church, where there is a sort of an ambient sound. It's not sound really to listen to, it's sound that you feel in your body when you walk through.
Yes. It's like a moving object all the time. It also, because it's live and it's not recorded, you also have this you get this feeling of like reality that I find quite interesting, apart from like recorded sound where you actually, I mean, it's pre-recorded. This is live, it's all the time. It can change any time. It just depends on what comes into the radio.
So it's sound that's live in the sense it's receiving radio broadcasts now and then presenting them in this space, so it's not pre-recorded sound.
No, there's no recordings at all. But what we also do is that we use a CB radio, and we send out this sound to the fishing boats and the boats around here in Venice, so they can sit in their boats or whatever they have with their little communication radios, and they can listen to this music as well.
Now, the catalogue box has a vinyl record in it, and we could hear a bit of that next. Can you introduce that record and say what it is?
Basically, we have just sent to the producer of the record pieces that we made in at home in our home studios. I sat myself down in the studio and said, "So what do I want to do?" And I said, "I'll do a funk song." We just decided we wanted to have an audio record, and then we realized there's like all these CDs are floating around everywhere, and me and Tommy and Leif, especially, we're like DJing sometimes too, and we really like the vinyl record, so we made a 10-inch vinyl record instead, and just to show that sound is actually something that is very, very present in today's visual arts, of course. On the grounds that actually contemporary music has failed to recognize, for instance, a lot of electronic music, electroacoustic music, and sound installations and so on. So the visual art world has sort of taken over that sound part from contemporary music, I think. So we just wanted again to enhance the knowledge that sound is a real and a very present thing in contemporary art.
My name is Salla Tikka, and I'm a Finnish artist. This is my first time in Venice. It's also my first big international exhibition that I'm participating. I have one work at the Arsenale, and so it's a video work. It's a projection, and it's a 3-minute, 48-seconds long film with sound.
Tell me a little bit about the idea behind this piece.
The piece is called Lasso. Actually, it's a short story. It's an independent story, but it could be also one scene of a longer story. It tells about a girl and her fears. She's living in a kind of dream world. This girl is returning from a jog. She's jogging back to her house, and she tries to get in, but nobody answers and nobody opens the door, and so she goes around the house and she sees herself, or like her own reflection, in the big windows. But when she comes near the windows, she sees herself, and finally she's through the windows to the living room, and in the living room there is a boy without a shirt, only with jeans, and he's making like lasso tricks, and it's almost like dancing, and it's a slow motion image. We see how she's reacting to this, and she's not only upset, but I don't know if it's the right word, but yeah, she's curious as well, and stands there and watches more, and then he kind of gets more and more excited about what he's doing. He's not reacting to this girl. Kind of he's not feeling that she's watching, but she's still watching very intensive. And this guy's doing this lasso tricks faster and faster, and then in the end he hits the lasso to the ground. So she gets scared and takes a few steps away from the window. And then she sees again her reflection. And then there is this camera movement, like when she starts going backwards, so the camera starts panoramic to the earth, and it ends to the a little bit of snow. So that's what is happening.
But, well, a lot of people that have seen the piece reflected that there was it was a feminist issue, and it was also almost like the circle of the male world, and she and the outside spectator is there.
Yeah. I've been doing videos and photography like 5 years, and my issues are very feminist. Like, I'm a feminist and I'm concerned about these issues. And, but in this piece, it's about these two worlds, two very different worlds, and how this male world is protected in this very bourgeois surroundings, and she's kind of left outside of this world, and she cannot get in really, like literally. But also, it's not only her being unhappy; it's also him being unhappy, kind of trapped to this cube. The house is like very modernistic and cubic, so he's there also like as an animal only, and she's outside, but she's neither free. It's quite obvious that she'd like to go in, and she can't see what's happening around her. She only sees her own reflection, and if she's not seeing her own reflection, she sees to the house. So it's kind of like she won't see what's happening around, and like the nature, and she's not reacting to things.
It's like two closed systems.
Yeah. It is a feminist work, of course, but I think it's not so literal, and so it can be interpreted in many ways. People have very different kind of interpretations about it, like what's really happening there. And because there are no words, spoken words, I think that gives a lot of space also. And the music is this Ennio Morricone's Once Upon a Time in the West, this theme song. My piece Lasso was really inspired about of these Western movies, and I was watching quite a lot of these so-called spaghetti Westerns. I think they were like quite clear examples of the roles of women or men, and good and bad, and the nature and the society of the development, and there are so many contrasts, like clear contrasts. And then I was thinking the society, our like Western model, it's still the same. The roles are, they haven't been changing so much. I think if I'm looking at Westerns, I see them a little bit like if they were romantic in some very strange way. And they are. Yeah. I think I wanted to make a piece about this romanticism, romantizing this very cruel masculine world.
So if we move back in your career as an artist, how did it all start, this sort of awareness of feminist issues? And
I started taking photographs, really. Like, yeah, it's now almost 6 years ago. I had this quite bad eating disorder, and I had anorexia. I was quite unhappy with my life, and I couldn't kind of find a way of, you know, making art. So I started just taking photographs of myself, as many feminist artists before me, but I wasn't so aware about art. Throughout these photos, I just wanted to see how other people see me, and was I really so ugly? And then they were really therapeutic, these works to me.
And it's like an exorcism almost.
Yeah, so I took the photographs by myself. It was or the automatic in the camera, so there was no other people present, and it was very intimate situations. You know, this was helping me a lot already, and then I got more interested in the questions like, why am I suffering? And I feel I was full of hate, like, you know, I had to find somebody to blame of my illnesses. Or yeah, this is how I got more interested in feminism. Then I did some works about these role models and obsessions of being perfect or beautiful, or I don't know, it's always very autobiographical, so I work from my, like, feelings. It's not so literal anymore that it was in the beginning, but I think it was really important for me, these works, and I'm really proud that I did them. Like,
I was startled when I found out that in the Biennale there's only 20% female artists. That's the biggest number they've ever gotten up to is a representation of 20%, a fifth of the artists being female.
Is it now so? Oh, it's really strange, because I think in Finland we have a lot of strong female artists, and they have been quite known, you know, or like Finnish art has been known now abroad because of female artists. So it's quite shocking. But of course, it's this patriarchal system ruling here as well.
I'm here with Leonard Sokov at the Russian Pavilion. Leonard, I'd just like to talk about your installation, where you have made these pieces referencing other artists. You have a very long and distinguished practice, and I would just like to talk to you a little about how you conceived the piece to be here, and just talk about the ideas behind it, really,
and
the practicalities of making it as well.
It's the first idea, you know. I think a very big attention for very classical modern art in this situation, in modern sculpture. And this attention looks like 70, maybe 80% from all art, you know. This. I make it this but criticize this situation, because I think the public should have more attention to contemporary art, because contemporary art is what is reactions on the today's, you know. But usual people very conservative and interested about some classical Bridge Monet, you know, just like this. But interesting about sculpture look like museum interest. Or people very professional who make a show, looks like Giacometti, Henry Moore, Picasso, or people who is thinking about price, how much this is price, this is sculpture, but no about art. You know, and I make a box, sculpture looks like souvenirs, and very small, around 120. Make it from their shadow. And the glasses box is, looks like museum, and the shadows, mythologic shadow with what is we living. That's, every shadow is bigger than art pieces, you know. Everything is movie. And this is my first idea, but this idea have a couple levels. If you're looking inside sculptures, I make it scale. What is my imagination? What is sculptures? Is big scale? What is I like it? The small, like this scales. What is I don't like it? You know, I make it Netrebko size. Looks like Man Ray, Malevich, Oppenheimer, and smaller. Looks like socialistic sculpture. Looks like Nazi sculpture. Looks like Torah. Looks like this. This next level, but selected this is sculpture. At first, is of course objective. Who is better? Who is looks like in history art? No, my select, but in history art. Next is what is I like it? And next idea, of course, century is finished and should be looking on the back and what has happened. That's and a couple ideas in this situation. But of course, it's visual. This looks like boxes. This museum and shadow. This shadow. This sculpture with what is really. That's it.
Do you think that this piece you have made for the Biennale is also out of a little bit of frustration about how we regard art? As you say, you know, you have included Russian artists that have influenced you are trying to have a dialogue with, you know, we must move on now, we must look to the future, not always back at the past.
No, you know, if you don't know back, you can't looking in future, you know. It's,
of
what
course.
Is why is this make it? It's, yeah.